executive producer Isaac Saul. This is Tangle.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Tangle Podcast, the place we get views from across the political spectrum, some independent thinking, and a little bit of my take. I'm your host, Isaac Saul, and on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Israel-Hamas hostage swap, news of which broke early this morning. We were planning to cover the George Santos controversy and ethics report and his decision not to run for re-election, but we've given that story a bit of coverage, and we haven't covered the Israel, Hamas, Palestine, Gaza story in a week or two, and it feels like this is a big enough development that we should jump in. So we pivoted. We're going to cover that today. But before we jump in, I want to give a quick thank you. Yesterday was our biggest subscription haul in Tangle history. As we announced, prices for our memberships are going from $50 to $60 per year at the end of this year. But you can still subscribe right now for $40 per year for your first year on our Black Friday deal. Legacy subscribers, that is people who subscribe before our subscription prices go up, won't see their prices change. And many of them also wrote in asking if they could pay the new price as a way to support us, which, yes, we will allow you to do that. Obviously, that's an awesome thing for us, and we appreciate all that incredible support. And as I mentioned yesterday, next up on our list now is launching some premium content here on the newsletter, including getting our Friday editions into podcast form and generally just doing some more stuff that is kind of behind a paywall, because I know there are some people who are just podcast listeners and don't actually read the newsletter, which is great. So again, thank you guys all so much for the support. Yesterday was incredible. So many new members who have jumped, and it's just really special. We have an awesome community. All right, with that out of the way, we'll kick things off with some quick hits. First up, OpenAI, the parent of ChatGPT, announced late Tuesday that it had reached a deal for Sam Altman to return as CEO after Altman was ousted by the board earlier this week. Number two, the United States carried out several airstrikes in Iraq for the third time since January 2020 after a group of Iran-backed militants attacked U.S. troops. Number three, Representatives Anna Issue, the Democrat from California, and Bill Johnson, the Republican from Ohio, announced they were retiring from Congress. Number four, North Korea says it has successfully launched its first military satellite into orbit on its third attempt. And number five, X, formerly known as Twitter, has sued Media Matters over its report that ads on the platform were appearing next to anti-Semitic content.
We turn to the other major news this Tuesday night, and there is breaking news as we're on the air here in the West involving Israel's war with Hamas. The breaking developments at this hour involving the hostages. We have learned that a tentative deal has now been reached to free a number of hostages held in Gaza.
Now, as we've been reporting, the Israeli government has been discussing a potential hostage deal now with Hamas. Under the agreement, we understand Hamas would release 50 hostages in exchange for a temporary ceasefire, fuel, and the release of Palestinian prisoners.
The released hostages would be women and children only, and freed during a four-day pause, they say. In return, Israel would release 150 Palestinian women and children prisoners, convicted, an Israeli official says, as accomplices in terror offenses.
Early Wednesday, Israel and Hamas agreed to a hostage deal that involves a four-day pause in fighting. It is the first ceasefire since Hamas's attack on Israel October 7th that sparked 6 weeks of air and ground assaults in the Gaza Strip. As part of the deal, at least 50 women and children from the estimated 240 people being held hostage in Gaza will be released, and the pause in fighting will be extended an extra day for every 10 hostages Hamas releases. Hamas says the deal will include the release of 150 Palestinian women and teenagers from Israeli prisons, which includes three Americans, that's two women and a girl, according to a Biden official. Further, around 300 aid trucks will be allowed to enter Gaza each day during the ceasefire. Qatar, the country mediating the deal, said the humanitarian pause will begin 24 hours after the agreement was struck. Families in Israel will also be given time to challenge the prisoner release, according to Israeli officials. Of the 240 hostages taken on October 7th, four hostages, including two Americans, have already been released by Hamas in pairs. A fifth hostage was rescued, and two other hostages have been found dead. An estimated 1,200 people were killed in Hamas's initial attack, according to Israeli officials. Since Israel's bombardment of Gaza began, an estimated 11,000 Palestinians have been killed, according to the Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry. That includes at least 4,600 children. The ministry does not record whether the dead are militants or civilians, nor does it include people who are stuck under rubble or not brought to hospitals, leading many international aid groups to believe the numbers are an undercount of the death toll. We have a link to more information about how the health ministry calculates the dead in an article from The Economist. One Gaza health official said they have lost the ability to count the dead because of the collapse of the health system. An estimated 1.5 million Gazans are now internally displaced. Israeli soldiers have taken over most of northern Gaza, pushing civilians into the south. Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City has become a main target of the ground invasion in the north, and Israeli officials have been releasing evidence and inviting journalists to come see tunnels built near and underneath the hospital that it says belong to Hamas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has continued to pledge an end to the war only once Hamas is destroyed, and has emphasized that it embeds itself in civilian infrastructure, necessitating combat in densely populated areas. Now, Israel is believed to be pushing south, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have fled in the last few weeks. Israel recently dropped leaflets in Khan Yunis, the largest city in the south, telling civilians to move west before they shell the area. Meanwhile, a senior U.S. official told Reuters that Israel has no choice but to push south if it wants to vanquish Hamas. As Israeli soldiers advance, they necessarily have to control the territory behind them, leading many to believe a full reoccupation of Gaza is coming despite Israeli officials denying that is their plan. Today, we're going to break down some reactions to the hostage deal and the latest from the conflict, sharing views from the left and the right, and then my take. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break. First up, we'll start with what the right is saying. The right is mixed in its reaction to the deal, with many saying it underscores the moral quandary at the heart of the conflict. Some say Hamas needs the ceasefire more than Israel, as its fighters have been overwhelmed by the IDF. Others oppose the deal and call it a win for Hamas. The Wall Street Journal editorial board said the deal is a great relief to the innocents and their families. Israeli leaders believe the trade is worth it, and it's not our place to second-guess their judgment, the board said. In exchange for returning Israeli children and women, 12 or 13 a day, Hamas is set to receive a four-day pause in Israeli military operations and the release of about 150 of its under-18 and female operatives from Israeli prisons. During the ceasefire, Israel will allow more fuel and aid into Gaza. The pause might also extend longer if Hamas gives up more hostages, 10 for each additional day, the board said. The deal again shows the moral gulf between the two sides. Hamas kidnapped Israeli children as young as 9 months to use as hostages and spring its jihadists who have been arrested or convicted in a fair trial for their crimes. Israel takes military risks to save its citizens. Hamas risks Palestinian civilians to save itself. Even as Israelis rejoice for the women and children who will return home, they know Hamas is rejoicing too. Its war crimes have been rewarded. It will steal fuel from its own people to power its terror tunnels. Its shattered northern Gaza brigades will use the ceasefire to regroup, escape from weak positions, and set more ambushes for Israeli troops. In The Spectator, Lamora Simhoni-Philpott wrote about why Hamas agreed to the ceasefire. When the war started, the Israeli government prioritized military accomplishments against Hamas over negotiating the release of hostages. Hamas, too, was unwilling to negotiate in the early days of the conflict. Two things have changed, Philpott said. The first is that Hamas has struggled to fight the Israeli Defense Forces. The IDF has been targeting Hamas's infrastructure, tunnels, weapons caches, and individuals from the ground, air, and sea. Despite launching a successful surprise attack on October 7th, Hamas's capabilities are no match for the IDF. Second, on the Israeli side, priorities have reversed in the past few days. Hostages now come first, destroying Hamas comes second. In the past 2 weeks, the families of the hostages and their supporters have significantly increased their pressure on the government. Large demonstrations and marches were held across the country. Their campaign has received a lot of public sympathy and support and placed political pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu to negotiate with Hamas. It also became clear that releasing the hostages by military means and alive is a near impossible task. In town hall, Matt Vespa criticized this Israel-Hamas hostage deal. It was probably agreed upon after intense international pressure, which is tragic, as it shows scores of world leaders cannot identify pure evil. Hamas is a terrorist organization with the backing of most Palestinian civilians. The Gaza Strip is a terrorist factory. There should be no deal until every Hamas dog is put down, Vespa wrote. Shin Bet and Mossad better have a plan to kill the terrorists that are about to be released into the wild. The next question regarding this agreement is obvious. How long will it take Hamas to break it? We probably should have expected this since the Israeli ground operation to remove Hamas, which has entrenched itself in Gazan socio-political life for 17 years, would take time. The images of bombed out cities, death and destruction have infuriated pro-terrorist lefties who dominate cultural bastions of power and influence. Some pause agreement lasting days was going to happen, even though Israel has enacted hours-long ones to allow civilians to reach safety out of Gaza war zones. Hamas gets a breather. Therefore, this deal is a win for them. All right, that is it for what the right is saying, which brings us to what the left is saying. The left is hopeful the deal will mark the start of additional diplomatic breakthroughs in the conflict. Some worry the ceasefire will be difficult to maintain given the dueling motivations on each side. Others say Israel was right to take the deal, but acknowledge the sacrifices they had to make to do so. In the Washington Post, David Ignatius said this deal could gradually expand to a broader de-escalation of the nightmare conflict. The basic idea driving the hostage release agreement, approved by Israel's cabinet early Wednesday in Jerusalem, is more for more, a formula that's well known in arms control negotiations, Ignatius said. If Hamas delivers more hostages, Israel will be willing to extend the pause, a senior Israeli official told me. There's no cap on how long Israel might halt its Gaza operations, he said, as Israel seeks eventual release of all captives, including those in the military. The deal, brokered by Qatar's Prime Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, is a case study in how diplomatic mediation works. The channel was in part an intelligence operation managed quietly by the CIA and Israel's Mossad. Qatar, though blasted by some Israelis for sheltering Hamas terrorists, proved an indispensable intermediary, Ignatius said. Over time, both Israel and Hamas came to trust the reliability of the messenger. A senior Biden administration official also credited Egypt for helping make the deal work. In Bloomberg, Mark Champion explored what a truce in Gaza means for the war. For the alleviation of suffering among Gaza's civilian population, the deal could not be more welcome or necessary. But for those doing the fighting, a pause will matter little beyond providing both sides with an opportunity to regroup, Champion said. The IDF's task is to eliminate Hamas's military capabilities, and that job is far from complete, making it unlikely that Israel would allow the pause to extend to a more permanent truce. Hamas might like that to happen, but assuming it doesn't, a short pause hardly advances its goal of extending the war and its attendant suffering until either Hezbollah, Iran, or the international community intervenes. Israel, meanwhile, could demonstrate its goal is not collective punishment by making room for the compromises that would be needed for such a surrender and for a longer-term arrangement in Gaza other than reoccupation. The ceasefire could also get what it's doing on the ground in line with a strategic plan currently missing for what happens afterward. But don't hold your breath. Given the maximalist goals on both sides, even assuming this halt in hostilities can last its intended duration, expect more war. In Arab news, Mohammed Shabarro argued that hateful rhetoric will remain a threat to hopes of peace. One would hope this agreement will pave the way for reason to triumph over the flood of hate that has been pouring out ever since Hamas gunmen killed about 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, during cross-border raids on October 7th, Shabarro wrote. But references by Israeli officials, journalists, and influencers have crossed a Rubicon that threatens to make impossible any future climb down that would allow the two peoples to coexist. Hamas's narrative and rhetoric has been no better, as for years it has called for Israel to be wiped out and to throw Israelis into the sea, even justifying its violence, though this never reflected the mindset of all Palestinians. The inflammatory language can normalize the discussion of ideas that would have been off limits before October 7th. It risks becoming the new normal and further tearing apart peoples that have been condemned by geography to always live alongside each other, Shabarro said. One can only hope, therefore, that the initial truce and hostage exchange will instigate a reimagining of the peace process. But the damage caused by the insightful rhetoric in the wake of October 7th attacks is likely to plague both peoples for the foreseeable future. right, that is it for the left and the right are saying, which brings us to my take. So this deal is a good step. Historically speaking, this conflict has been unpredictable. There have been 5 wars in 15 years, and the hostage swaps, peace deals, state-oriented solutions, ceasefires, advances, and retreats of certain causes that have happened over that time unfolded in ways that weren't obvious in real time or turned in ways people weren't expecting. For the first time since Hamas's attack, the door to a longer, more sustainable pause just cracked open. More than anything else, that is what this deal represents to me. 2 sides capable of negotiating with each other and each getting something they want out of doing so. I am so glad these first 50 hostages taken from Israel are going home. And that is about the most hopeful outlook I can muster right now. Since Hamas's attack, I've articulated 2 important points. First, Israel has no good options, and I didn't see any feasible path forward that made me comfortable. Second, my personal worst-case scenario was mass civilian death, a drawn-out war, and backsliding away from any kind of long-term solution. Given the bad option Israel chose, rooting out Hamas through a full military invasion, every single one of those fears is now coming true. Roughly 1 in every 200 Gazans is now dead, which is proportional to about 1.65 million Americans. Most of the dead are women, children, and newborns. More than 2/3 of the entire Gazan population has been displaced, and about 45% of Gaza's housing units have been destroyed. These accounts aren't just from the Hamas-controlled health ministry, which I've warned people to be skeptical about, but from international aid groups, journalists, civilians on the ground and in the region. The images from this war are hard to properly capture in words. It is a living nightmare. And that's the civilian toll. Netanyahu is now using words like indefinite to describe the Israeli security presence in Gaza. The idea that Israel would push south would have been incomprehensible a few weeks ago and now represents the dark reality of where we are. Remember, Israeli forces evacuated hundreds of thousands of civilians from the north to the south. Now they are being squeezed along the Egyptian border. The doubling of the population in the south has already left people fighting over food, water, and healthcare, all while Egypt refuses to open its borders. In that environment, Israel forces now intend to push forward. It is not clear where the civilians in the south are expected to go, and some Israeli officials are conceding that any incursion into the south is going to be more complicated and probably more deadly than what we've witnessed already. Of course, every time the Israeli military advances, it will have to occupy the territory behind it to protect itself, which means, as the IDF pushes forward, we can expect the territory behind it to be reoccupied as it was 20 years ago. This is why many Palestinians believe they are witnessing the beginning of a mass expulsion of Gazans from the region. Of course, Hamas is going to fight back and probably recruit militants to its cause, killing as many Israeli soldiers as it can throughout the conflict. And that's the drawn-out war. The last few weeks of fighting in Gaza have also coincided with an increase in clashes in the West Bank, on the other side of Israel, where Hamas is not in power. Attacks by Israeli settlers are increasing, Palestinian towns are being raided, and curfews are being imposed. This, while so much of Gaza is being destroyed, is going to do lasting and generational damage to any potential peace deal. As I've said before, every dead innocent civilian in Israel, Gaza, or the West Bank creates generational anti-Israel and anti-Palestinian sentiment that will be born among those who survive. That's the plain reality of how these conflicts work over time, and every new death carries with it new decades of hatred, eliminating opportunities for appeasement, negotiations, or peace for years to come. Whenever the fighting stops, it will take at least a generation to create a more lasting peace, but the fighting has to stop first. And those are the backward steps away from any kind of long-term solution. All the while, it's worth remembering the morbid realities of the options available to Hamas. From the first few days of this bombardment, Hamas could have recognized that it was outgunned and in over its head. It could have looked at the destruction around them and recognized what its attack and its 20 years of leadership had brought the Gazan people, and that only surrendering or giving up its hostages could stop what was happening. Of course, Hamas never considered such an option. It only promised more attacks. A couple of weeks ago, a Hamas spokesperson made this clear, quote, "I hope that the state of war with Israel will become permanent on all the borders and that the Arab world will stand with us," he said. Now, Hamas is once again faced with a choice. If it releases 50 hostages, as it has promised, that would leave about 190 in Gaza. It could feasibly stop any Israeli strikes for another 19 days, 10 hostages for each additional day of ceasefire, creating peace for nearly a month. Over that time period, thousands of aid trucks could enter Gaza in a grace period where Qatar, the United States, Egypt, and Jordan could help negotiate some longer, more lasting stop to the fighting. It's Pollyannish to expect them to take that route, but despite Israel's overwhelming military advantage and their own obvious moral failings in this conflict, it is also worth noting that Israel is giving Hamas options here, and everyone should judge their decisions accordingly. So that's where we are. A deal that gives a brief reprieve in an ocean of death, violence, and uncertainty about the future. While it's good news, it's hard to muster any long-term optimism. We'll be right back after this quick break. All right, everybody, that is it for my take today, which brings us to our reader question, which is from Scott in Houston, Texas. Scott said, what percentage of the population derives its income from our taxes? This should include local, state, and federal bureaucrats, school systems, military and welfare recipients. Social Security recipients should not be included. Okay, so this question contains a couple of other questions. First, how do you define income? There are a few different ways to do that, but since you're asking about the government, I think it makes sense to use a government definition. The Social Security Administration defines four different types of income: earned income, which is wages; unearned income, which is federal or private insurance payments or interest and dividends; in-kind income, which is the value of food or shelter; and deemed income, that's shared by a member of your household. So the number of people receiving income from our taxes, quote unquote, will include a lot of people who receive partial, supplemental, or temporary payments, often from disability programs or social insurance payments. That leads me to the second question. Why specifically ignore Social Security? I know it is common advice to not consider Social Security as part of your retirement income, but if you're making enough income after retirement age, either through wages or capital gains, then that is money taxed. And people who receive Social Security benefits have paid into it, so we don't like to think of it as an entitlement, even though it is. And of the entitlement programs, it's defined as an insurance program, along with unemployment, disability, and Veterans Affairs payments. So if we don't count Social Security, should we also not count those? Let's assume we can remove everyone receiving government insurance benefits. Are you asking about who receives government welfare as their exclusive source of income? That can be hard to tally, so let's include everyone who receives some welfare payment and exclude everyone who receives any form of insurance benefit. So, what are those welfare programs and how many people receive them? There are five major federal, state, and local welfare programs: Supplemental Security Income, that's SSI, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's SNAP, Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, that's WIC, and Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that's TANF, also known as TANF, and General Assistance, that's GA. All told, 65 million people receive some form of welfare. As for people who receive taxpayer money professionally, the government employs 23 million people in non-defense positions. There are another 2 million people employed in defense. Based on that data that I could find, that means roughly there are 90 million people who receive money from the government, excluding people getting insurance benefits. All right, that is it for your reader question today, which brings us to our Under the Radar section. More than 1 million gallons of crude oil leaked into the Gulf of Mexico near a pipeline off the coast of Louisiana, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. The Coast Guard first reported seeing the spill Friday and said Monday that it appears linked to the 67-mile-long Main Pass Oil Gathering Company's pipeline system, though it is still unclear where the oil is leaking from. Officials expressed concern about the leak's impact on endangered and threatened species. The vehicles will continue to survey the pipeline if weather conditions permit, the Coast Guard said. The Unified Command is working diligently to determine the source of the release. There have been no reports of injuries or shoreline impacts at this time. CBS News has the story, and there's a link in today's episode description. All right, next up is our numbers section. The number of days since Hamas's October 7th attack is 46. The amount of medical aid delivered to Gaza via the Rafah crossing since October 7th is 2,222 tons, according to the Egyptian government press office. The number of foreign nationals and dual nationals who have crossed the border from Gaza into Egypt through Rafah crossing since October 7th is 7,730. The number of residential units destroyed in Gaza since October 7th is 200,000. The number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since October 7th is 153. The number of Israeli soldiers killed since the start of the ground invasion is 29. The percentage of U.S. voters who say they support Israel and its war with Hamas is 80%, according to a new survey from Harvard Caps Harris poll. The percentage of 18 to 24-year-old voters who say they support Israel and its war with Hamas is just 55%. The percentage of voters older than 65 years old who say they support Israel and its war with Hamas is 95%. All right, that is it for our numbers section. And last but not least, a much-needed Have a Nice Day story. For years, doctors have treated allergies by exposing patients to gradually increasing doses of the allergen, which inoculates them to future exposures over time. Now, a special toothpaste may soon be available to help protect people with peanut allergies from having severe reactions. In a recent small trial, test subjects tolerated the highest dose of a toothpaste containing peanuts without any moderate or severe systemic reactions. Allergy expert Dr. William Berger described the process called oral mucosal immunotherapy. OMIT, as a delivery mechanism for peanut protein, has great potential for food allergy desensitization. Though it is still a distance from demonstrating consistent success, the peanut toothpaste may be able to desensitize patients to peanuts in a simple and accessible way without requiring dozens of visits to a clinic over a period of years. Good News Network has the story, and there's a link to it in today's episode description. All right, everybody, that is it for today's podcast. As I mentioned at the top, we are running a Black Friday discount for new subscriptions right now. You can get those by going to readtangle.com/Black Friday offer with dashes in between each word, or you can just follow the link that's in today's episode description. Also, we are off tomorrow and Friday for Thanksgiving, so I'm wishing you all a very happy and restful and peaceful Thanksgiving. I hope you guys can get some time with family or friends, or just some time to have a day off and eat a good meal. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have a good one. Peace. Our podcast is written by me, Isaac Saul, and edited and engineered by John Wall. The script is edited by our managing editor, Ari Weitzman, Will Kadak, Bailey Saul, and Sean Brady. The logo for our podcast was designed by Magdalena Bakova, who is also our social media manager. Music for the podcast was produced by Diet 75. And if you're looking for more from Tangle, please go to readtangle.com and check out our website.